Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Cory Doctorow. Cory Doctorow's a best-selling writer of science fiction. He's an award winner with the John Campbell Award. He's the author, co-author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Publishing Science Fiction. His articles appear all over the web. He's also a blogger, blogs for boingboing.net. Congratulations on your various science fiction awards and the fact that your book is out. 60,000 downloads?
It's actually closer to 80,000.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's talk about the book a little bit because it's quite a novel thing that you're doing. There have been a couple other e-book publishing ventures, but you've gotten Tor, a print publisher, to agree to allow you to distribute the book for free on the web. How was that? How did you convince them to do that?
Well, you know, I was very lucky in that my editor at Tor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, who runs the science fiction and fantasy line there, which is the largest of its kind in the English-speaking world, is very clued in, technologically speaking. He's a blogger, he's a Unix guy, he's an old Usenet hand, he runs his own Linux box, and he's a great fan of the Creative Commons and Larry Lessig and related subjects. And when I told him that I wanted to do this, he thought it was a great idea. So I'm not sure how much selling he had to do internally to convince his boss that this was a good idea. But certainly in terms of selling this to him, it was a dawdle. I just said, hey, Patrick, this is what I want to do. And he said, what a great idea.
Because the buzz around ebooks has been considerably more restrained than the buzz around the advent of the digital commons for music and video. Because music and video, you can relatively easily upload it onto the web and share it with everybody, but with a book, with a print book, you would need to scan every page in, and so people don't seem to like to read on the online, although you've written against that.
Yeah, I actually think that that's just a shibboleth. It's an urban legend that people don't like to read online because we all read online. I mean, if you look at the number of words read in any given day, I'm willing to bet that the vast majority of them are read off a screen. It may be that people don't want to read long-form works or some other variant of that off the screen. Even that, I think, is suspect. You know, most of the people I know spend 8 to 12 hours a day in front of a screen, and certainly that's a growing, not diminishing, segment of the population, as opposed to people who read words off of paper, which is definitely a percentage of the population that's been in free fall pretty much for the last, 10, 20 years. You know, we read less and less and less off of paper. I've heard a stat. It may be an urban legend that 1 in 10 Americans reads one book or more a year. And that's dismal. And when you consider that, people like me read dozens and dozens of books a year, you have to imagine that the number is really quite lower. That if the average American is reading decimal one books a year, then in fact most Americans are reading a lot less than that. So I think that that's a bit of a shibboleth. What's unique about Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom is it's, I believe, the first book to be commercially released as a no-fooling, dead-tree, words-on-paper book and simultaneously released with a license that allows you to redistribute it for free online. And my thinking there was that the people who are currently engaged in this practice of, spending 60 to 80 hours tearing the binding off a book and scanning it and making it available on the Internet are doing something that in any other circumstance would be characterized as promotional activity. Right? And promotional activity is the one thing that new writers have very little of. It's a kind of paradox of publishing and of indeed of all media that the less likely you are to need promotion to make your book sell, i.e., the closer you are to Stephen King, the larger your promotional budget will be. So they could not spend a nickel on the next Stephen King release and it would still be a bestseller. Maybe not as big a bestseller, but it would still be a bestseller nevertheless. It's unlikely that you'll get a whole lot of nickels spent on your promotion if you're a first-time novelist. And so I said, here are these people engaged in something that can be loosely characterized as promotion, albeit illegal promotion, or at least infringing promotion. And maybe if I just gave them a copy of the book, which will be of higher quality than anything they'll ever produce with an OCR package and hand editing, if I gave them this very high-quality edition, they would spend some fraction of that 80 hours actually just telling people about the book and how good it is and that they should read it and perhaps buy it or, invest in my next book or what have you. And that seems to have been the case. I mean, there has been an enormous amount of word-of-mouth activity around this book. And word-of-mouth is how first-time novels become successful novels. You know, the sterling example of this is this book called The Secrets of Yaya's Sisterhood, which was adapted as a film last year or the year before. And Secrets of Yaya's Sisterhood was this obscure mid-list title from a writer no one had ever heard of, but it inspired groups of women to actually form fan clubs, sisterhoods, where they would get together and they would enact and create rituals from the book and create their own rituals based on them. And they had conferences and conventions and party nights and mailing lists and so on. And the book became not just a bestseller, but like a mega seller, and became licensed for film and so on and so on and so on. And the woman who wrote that book can now write her ticket in terms of her next work and so on. As for me, the people who I expect to be reading this book are people who are geographically dispersed. They are not people who will all meet in a pub and have a Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom party, because they don't live anywhere near each other, and if they do, they probably never see each other face-to-face, although they may be quite good friends. These people exist in a social milieu that's almost entirely online, and by giving them an electronic copy of the book, I enable them to do that kind of hand-to-hand, word-of-mouth promotion that made books like Yaya's Sisterhood a success.
This is Dr. J. You're listening to Change Server Radio, and we're speaking today with Cory Doctorow. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction writer, a blogger for BoingBoing.net. He's an evangelist for open source technology and many, many other things. Let's talk for a second about the open source stuff that you did before this publishing adventure. You were working for OpenCola, which was
I co-founded it.
You co-founded OpenCola.
Yeah.
And tell us the philosophy of OpenCola.
So OpenCola was, I'm not sure actually what they're up to now, because I haven't been involved in the company for a little over a year now, but OpenCola was a project that would build a distributed peer-to-peer collaborative filter, so something that would recommend works to your attention based on how people in the network who had previously identified works that you found enjoyable responded to new works. That's kind of a convoluted way of explaining it, but the actual workflow is very simple. You've got a folder on your desktop, and you put things in it that you like, and it finds people whose folders contain similar things and puts the things that they know about that you don't in your folder. And if you keep them, it increases the probability that those people will, that the things that those people like will show up in your folder. And if you remove them, it decreases that probability. And because everyone in the system is partaking in this, it forms a kind of zero-cost recommendation and marketing network that would allow any work in the network to migrate very quickly to all the people who are likely to be interested in it. And one of the things about the present-day internet reality of publishing, publishing software and games and music and books and all the other activities that we think of as publishing, is that because the marginal cost of publishing has dropped pretty much to zero, anyone can make anything available to anyone else anywhere in the world, the cost of marketing anything has increased to infinity, right? Marketing, the cost of marketing is kind of a function of how many other works you're competing with. And in this world, you're competing with all of them. And so the idea was to solve that problem and level the playing field so that the people who were independent creators, people who had just started out, people who didn't have a marketing budget, could automatically put their works in front of people who were likely to enjoy them without having to be affiliated with giant corporations.
And you've been inspired, you put actually this concept into Down Now in the Magic Kingdom as a kind of central function of the social order, which you call the WFHE, but you're inspired by eBay's reputations and Google's page ranks and Slashdot's concept of karma, all the different democratic bottom-up systems of reputation ranking.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in collaborative filtering and in reputation systems. The thing that really got me churning about Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom was watching Napster. Napster and the systems that are its successors, the Nutellas and the Kazaas and so on, are a really different kind of economics than any of their predecessors. Even people who believed that we would eventually reach a point of plenty, say Marx, never understood that there would be a mechanism whereby plenty wasn't the result of a surplus, right? Marx thought that you would just that the way that you'd end up without scarcity is by just having lots of stuff, and Keynes believed much the same thing. But in the Napster world, the thing that makes something less scarce is the consumption of it. So downloading a file in Napster actually makes another copy of the file available. The more popular a file is, the easier it is to get. And this is kind of a reverse of the traditional problems of economics. You know, we have economists who talk about the tragedy of the commons, where if you have a place where everyone grazes their sheep, eventually that field will be denuded because someone will come to the realization that if he doesn't denude the field with his sheep, the next person that comes along will, and then his sheep won't get fed. And so the first person who reaches the field, if they're rational, just cleans it out. In an afterworld, you have this kind of commons where the sheep eat grass, where the more you graze, the more you get. And that kind of post-scarcity economics really intrigues me because, you know, first of all, we live in what's often called an information economy, at least one where informational goods are accounting for a significant fraction of the economic activity. And we're also, if you believe futurists, headed towards a world where physical goods will also be non-scarce in this way, you know, through biotech and nanotech and so on. And managing an economy where things are valuable but not scarce, and the more valuable they are, the less scarce they become, is a really different kind of problem than those that everyone who's come before have addressed. And so in the book, I had this thing called Woofy, and it's a reputation system. And all goods are non-scarce, with the exception of ones that are inherently scarce, like Disney World, right? There's only one of them. And the way that those goods are allocated, the way that people figure out who's running Disney World, is by whether or not people treat the people who lay claim to Disney World as though they belong to be there. So you can imagine a restaurant where your chance of being the maitre d' is directly correlated with whether or not people sit where you tell them to, whether or not servers serve people when you tell them to, when you seat them, whether or not the cooks cook for the people who you've seated, and so on. And if you don't like the way the maitre d' is running the restaurant, you simply step in and start seating people. And if the waiters serve them, if the cooks cook for them, if people sit where you tell them to, then you're the de facto maitre d' of the restaurant. And the book concerns one of these wars over who gets to control the rides in Disney World, and more particularly their destiny, whether or not they'll be rehabbed into rides that have higher throughput and are therefore more capable of generating more woofy for the people who run them, or whether they'll be kept in a kind of preservationist sense and retained in the form that Walt and the Imagineers built them in.
You know, your book is just great, and I've loved the concepts in it. I've been struggling for years, and this radio show is dedicated to the problematic of the future of democracy and participatory democracy and socialist ideas in a post-human or transhuman future. And your book really addresses that. It talks about the sense of meaning that people will seek when they have transhuman bodies or, you know, potential eternal life spans. And it's just great from that perspective. I want to go back to some of your background. You come from a left-wing family. You call yourself currently a political agnostic, though.
Yeah, you know, my folks are you know, not necessarily doctrinaire, but they're Trotskyists, and I was raised in that milieu. And Marx and Trotsky and Lenin, as well as Keynes and Smith and all the other great economic and political thinkers, had a lot to say that's interesting and valid, but not necessarily applicable in this kind of post-scarcity world. I am a believer in bottom-up. And in that sense, I am something of a libertarian. I think that it's hard to use the Internet and live on the Internet and not come to understand that centralized systems are in many ways more brittle and less useful than decentralized bottom-up systems. But at the same time, you know, I hail from Canada, and one of the things that continually frustrates me about living in the States is just how terrible private medicine turns out to be as compared to socialized medicine. And I believe in general that there are some costs that when socialized actually turn out to be a better deal for everyone. I think it's hard to be a true libertarian unless you have unless you experience real visceral moral indignation at the thought of free riders. And frankly, I don't give a damn about free riders. Whether we're talking about welfare cheats that might cost $50 a month to the state in the form of welfare payments and $100 a month to the state in the form of rooting them out and making sure that they don't get any money, or whether we're talking about people in a Napster network or another file-sharing network who download files but don't upload files. In both cases, I think that a rational economic position is that it's cheaper for everyone not to worry about the scarcity because there really isn't much, and not to worry about the free riders because they don't frankly cost all that much, and most people aren't free riding, and certainly if they are, they won't forever. And to just sort of go ahead and say, okay, well, this cost has been socialized. It's a net good. There are places where it fails, but let's not let the great be the enemy of the good.
This is Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. We're talking today with Cory Doctorow. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction author, an evangelist for open source ideas and for nationalized health insurance, social medicine, and a Canadian expatriate. Where are you living now, in Los Angeles?
San Francisco.
Okay, good. But a former Torontoan. Today, there are demonstrations all across the industrialized and non-industrialized world. There are big, huge demonstration in New York. There was a huge demonstration in Melbourne yesterday against this unilateralist campaign for war against Iraq. Personally, I'm for ousting Saddam, but only, with blue helmets. I'm wondering, it's hard to avoid in this particular context for futurists like us. Where are you coming out? What are your feelings in the context of the current apocalyptic climate about the nature of the future?
Well, I was talking about this with some friends yesterday. First of all, we should note that the demonstrations are actually quite enormous. The BBC is reporting that 1.5 million people marched in London. That's the largest demonstration England has ever seen. And comparable to the kind of turnout you'd get for the wedding of Prince Di and Charles. I mean, this is unheard of, and historically without precedent. And what's more, the thing about these demonstrations that is fascinating from a sort of futuristic perspective is that they are being covered in a distributed fashion. The BBC has actually explicitly solicited photos of demonstrations from around the world from people who are on the ground in the crowd, taken with camera phones and with digital cameras and uploaded to their website. And if you go to the Beeb right now, you can actually see current photos of what's going on all over the world at these demonstrations. It's quite amazing.
Not to mention the indie media phenomenon, which distributed progressive grassroots journalists.
But here it is leaking back into mainstream media. I mean, the anti-Beeb is generally thought of as pretty stodgy. And there's the grand old lady, asking people to smart mob the demonstrations and send her photographs from their little grainy 480 by 640 camera phones so that they can put them on the wire. It's really quite phenomenal.
It's very Sterling-esque.
Yeah, it is, very much so. So, I was talking with this about some friends yesterday, and someone asked me if I was a pessimist or an optimist. And I said, well, you've got to be a little of both. So on the one hand, I believe that we live in an age of wonders. And I believe that we are headed into an age of wonders. The advances that we have seen in technology and science and in social systems and in the ability of individuals to come together to affect change in the last 10 or 15 years are truly staggering. Whether you want to plot a curve of storage costs and size over time, or network speed or processor speed, or the ability of individuals to contact their lawmakers, or the ability of individuals to organize, or what have you, we live in an age of wonders, and those wonders will not cease. And it's because I'm so optimistic about the future that I am also so frightened by broad swipes against the future. It's because I think the future is so promising that I think that the Jack Valentis and John Ashcrofts of this world are so deadly and threatening. And you can't be a pessimist about that stuff without first being an optimist about what would happen if that stuff didn't come to pass. And so I think that, we have on the one hand people like Jack Valenti who are arguing an argument that is equivalent to saying that Ford shouldn't be allowed to ship a car unless they can guarantee that it'll never be used to drive a bank robber away from a bank robbery, only applying it to computers and other general-purpose hardware and saying computers shouldn't be allowed to be marketed. Unless networks shouldn't be built and software shouldn't be released unless you can guarantee that no one will ever do anything bad to the people he represents with him.
Funny, they never make that argument about guns.
Without getting too deeply into it, because the Second Amendment is frankly a rat hole, that you dig into and never come out of and rarely get anything useful from. But without getting too deep into it, the substantial non-infringing uses for a computer are more substantial than the non-fatal uses for a handgun, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
you know, and so it's not apples and apples when you talk about guns versus computers, although there are parallels. So on the one hand, you have the Valentis of the world saying, all technology that is general purpose, that's end-user modifiable, that can be used to harm our interests, should be removed from the market. And on the other, you have people like John Ashcroft, who are building a bonfire of fear and hatred, and on the smoldering corpses of the September 11th dead, I can't imagine a thing less respectful to martyrs who were brutally and senselessly murdered than to use this to their advantage, than to use this to gain political advantage. And he's using them as an excuse to erode fundamental civil liberties, especially in respect of technology, that are important to the building of a good and civil society. And I think both of those attacks, that two-pronged attack, is potentially deadly. I think that it's nightmarish.
Tell us about the Electronic Frontier Foundation and what it does.
So EFF is a straight-up civil liberties group with a twist, and that twist is that we only work on technology issues. So you have groups like the ACLU that are very good and work on things like First Amendment freedoms, the right to assemble, the right to privacy, the right to undertake your life without government interference, without unfair government interference. And those are exactly the same rights we defend, but our position is that just because those rights are being exercised through a computer doesn't mean that they should be treated any differently from how they are treated in the real world. And the ACLU has the same position, but unfortunately the government doesn't. And so this all started 12 or 13 years ago when Steve Jackson Games shipped a game module called GURPS Cyberpunk, which was a game, a role-playing game, rules for a role-playing game about computer crime. And the NSA decided that this was, in fact, a manual for computer crime and seized all of Steve Jackson's equipment, including a BBS that had email from dozens and dozens and dozens of Steve Jackson game customers who were communicating with each other. And they read all of this private email and attempted to introduce it into evidence and so on. They did it without a wiretap warrant. And we went to court and we said, we have a reasonable expectation of privacy in our mail and in our phones, and we should have that same reasonable expectation of privacy in our email. And if the NSA or any other law enforcement agency wants to read your private email, they should have to go to a judge and satisfy the same criteria that they have to satisfy if they want to listen in on your private phone conversation. And nothing less will do. And we won that case. And it stood for 12 years. It stood, in fact, until last summer, when the Homeland Security Act was passed at the 11th hour by the lame duck Senate, and they included at the last minute the provisions of the Computer Security Enhancement Act, which now allows any government employee to read your private email with your ISP's permission without a warrant from a judge. So a high school principal can go to an internet service provider and say, I believe that my students are sending private email that indicate a drug plot, or an intention to shoot up the school, or what have you. And without convincing a judge, if he can convince the ISP can turn over the private email of that high school principal's students and not fall afoul of any of the privacy protection that we have under the law, not run afoul of any breach of contract that they may have with you to protect your privacy. This is dreadful and apocalyptic, frankly. EFF has, since then, worked on a lot of other issues. I mean, we established in the early 90s, we fought the crypto wars, and we established the principle that strong cryptography, that is to say, technological techniques for scrambling a message such that it cannot be read if it's intercepted, should be allowed for civilian use and should be exported. And up until then, the National Security Agency and other law enforcement bodies had argued that the American public, and particularly foreign nationals, shouldn't have access to any scrambling technology that was so strong that they couldn't break it. And they raised the specter of the four horsemen of the apocalypse: pirates, mafioso, child pornographers, and terrorists. And they said, you know, these people will make use of your magical encryption technology, and we will be powerless to stop them unless you allow us to cripple the capacity of all Americans and all citizens of the world to communicate in private. And it's a dreadful argument. It was no more valid when the framers of the Constitution were writing the fundamental privacies that we enjoy today into the Constitution than it is today. And we won this case, and the way that we won it is by arguing that the source code, the computer code that constituted these encryption algorithms, was a form of protected speech. It was publication for the purposes of the First Amendment, and the government had no business passing laws in respect of it. And again, that looks like it's going to get rolled back in the next version of the USA Patriot Act, which will provide for very harsh penalties for people who use encryption as a in furtherance of a crime. So in other words, if your Kazaa client has encryption built into it to ensure that uses cryptographic ciphers to ensure that the file that you're downloading is the file that you think you're downloading, and it turns out that you're infringing, in addition to any infringement liability, you will bear a great deal of additional liability, criminal liability, for having used cryptography in the furtherance of a crime. It's really terrifying as well. We do a lot of copyright reform as well, because copyright has become the way that people stifle dissent. It's become the way that people abridge innovation. In addition to this notion that technologists shouldn't be allowed to make technology that someone somewhere might use unlawfully, there's also the continued harassment of people who post critical works on the web and the people who host those critical works. For example, the Church of Scientology routinely goes after search engines and internet service providers and says these critics of our work are infringing on our copyright by quoting our work in their criticism. This is, in fact, a fair use. And under the provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, a very bad law that was passed in 1998, you must remove it. And the only way that it can get reposted is if you choose, if you, Mr. Internet Service Provider or Mr. Search Engine Runner, choose at your discretion, you can go back to the person whose works you're removing, and you can say, do you disagree with the Church of Scientology that this is infringing? And if they're willing to sign an affidavit, they can put it back up. Now, in practice, what almost always happens is the search engine or the Internet service provider says, it's not worth our time, it's not worth our energy, and criticism falls silent. And it's a bad day for democracy when the only thing that you need to do to silence your critics is assert that they're violating your copyright, and they go quietly away.
That sounds like excellent work. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, and we're talking today with Cory Doctorow. He's a science fiction writer, an evangelist for open source ideas and an open source social order. We have to bring it to a close pretty quick. I really want to thank you for joining us today. When's your next book coming out? You've got another book that's in the works.
So I have two more books coming out this year. One is a short story collection, From Four Walls, Eight Windows, and it's called A Place So Foreign and Eight More. It'll be out in September. And then the next novel is something called Eastern Standard Tribe, and that will be out from Tor Books in November.
And people can visit your writing at Boing Boing, B-O-I-N-G, B-O-I-N-G.net. Boing Boing started as a zine, didn't it? As a print.
That's right. My co-editor, Mark Fraunfelder, started it with his wife and some other people. And it was a great print scene in the old days. I actually grew up on it. And when Mark turned Boing Boing into a blog, somewhere along the line, I ended up guest editing it while he was away on holidays. And when he came back, I ended up sticking around. And now I do probably the majority of the posting on the blog. And we have two other co-editors, Shenny Jardin and David Peskovitz from the Nanotechnology Lab at Berkeley. And it's a fun weblog. It's got a really, really wide and diverse readership. I get surprising emails sometimes from, you know, great technologists and captains of industry of various stripes who say, you know, I read your blog every day, religiously, signed CEO of Fortune 100 company. I go, Jesus Christ, CEO of Fortune 100 company is reading my blog. And you know, I just this morning used the word ass. But it's pretty keen. And the other place you can go to is craphound.com, craphound.com, which is my personal website where you can download a copy of the full text of Down at the Magic Kingdom.
Thanks so much, Cory. Your work is wonderful. You're one of the great 1,000 points of light out there in the blogosphere.
Oh, thank you.
So, and I hope that that this contributes to some sales for your book.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.